You know, the results were probably pretty about how I grew up for several reasons, one of which was an alcoholic home, and there was a lot of ugliness, and it's still hard to talk about to go over one more time. A lot of you grew up that way, you know, and there were a lot of people in my life when I was a child, and I talk about this so I can tell you about my attitudes. In my life as a child, who talked to me about the difference between good and evil and right and wrong. And, you know, I've listened to a lot of people talk from the podium, and oftentimes it seems as though I hear them talking about a lot of anger and a lot of rebellion in those young years. It can begin to sound like a requirement for membership, and I wasn't that way. You know, I listened to those people.
We are a small group, but we are mighty.
Be proud of me. I wanted to make them feel good about me. I didn't have that feeling of rebellion at that point in time. We all have fantasies when we're kids, and sometimes if I talk about it, it tells you everything you really need to know about me, because a big part of it's still true today. But when we're kids, we all have fantasies of how we want to be when we're all grown up. And for a lot of little girls, the fantasy is something like to be a model or an actress or a singer. You know, those things look glamorous when you're a little kid. And my fantasy was different, of course. And what I did was read through Butler's Lives of the Saints. And you can probably tell it's going to be weird already. Picked out the one that I liked the best, you know, that made the biggest impact on me, and that was Joan of Arc. And I'll tell you, I thought that woman had it all. In a lot of ways, I still do. She was a powerful historical figure. She changed the politics in a lot of ways of France at that time. She accomplished a lot of things. She was an amazing woman. She saw visions and heard voices. I had to get to the 60s to do that, but still, even then, it
worked for a while.
Impressed me. She was a woman in charge of a lot of men, and and I can see some of you see why I thought that was so attractive. And this is we laugh at it now, but you know, what I'm telling you is about how idealistic I was. And I have always lived in fantasy. I have never had a hold on reality. And I didn't have external trouble in those childhood years. I had a lot of emotional problems. I had a lot of severe problems. And I found an outlet in this kind of fantasy. And I never, until I got here, saw myself as a part of the world the way I am and the way you are. It had to always be different, and I have to watch for that in myself today. I'm someone who never had any trouble in school either. I always did very well without having to try very hard. Naturally, I wanted to think in those years it was because I was so smart. That's what people told me all the time. They talked about all that potential. And yet I really never had to try very hard. I did very well. And the truth in that, I think, is not a truth about intellect as much as it's a truth about me and how I relate to people. I have always found it easier to turn to books and to turn to things rather than to turn to you, to turn to people. People have always been hard for me. That is often true today, and it's certainly how I grew up. So I went through those years. I didn't even grow up in this country. I grew up a long ways away and came back here in my teen years and ended up graduating from a girls' high school in Long Beach, a Catholic girls' school, when I was 17. And I remember how I felt that June when I graduated. I remember how the world looked to me. You know, it looked real good. I had picked up a lot of ambition. It was the only way I knew I was ever going to amount to anything, and I was ambitious. And I knew exactly where I wanted to go and how I wanted to get there, and I enrolled that fall at Cal State Long Beach with a major in the sciences. And for a period of time, a short period of time, things fell in place for me there too, you know, the way they had before. And then, of course, something changed, and a lot had to have changed for me to be up here this morning. And that beginning of that change was a simple one. I simply began going to these college fraternity parties. And No one except someone who's gone to Catholic girls' school is going to understand what a radical difference that was for me. That it was a big change, and it was at one of those parties that I had my first drink. The guy was with my date, turned to me at this party, and asked me if I wanted a drink. And I would bet whatever the outside circumstances of our store, we all began drinking in a similar way. It was a group of my peers. It looked like everyone else was drinking. And I turned to him and I said, well, sure. You know, I can tell you, I remember I didn't stand there and I didn't think about it. And yet, maybe I should have. My family is full of alcoholism. It has been fatal for some of us, but not me. I never knew how to look at it that way. I didn't understand it was a disease. And the next question he asked me was, what would I like? What should he bring me to drink? And I set up a pattern right there that night at that party that I have broken only with great difficulty, I hope, here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was an overwhelming desire to be cool. You know, I was 17. I was naive. I was not sophisticated at all, but I wanted to seem different than I was. And I turned to him and I said, will you all bring me whatever looks good? And that man was no fool. You know, he did. What he thought looked good was a tumbler of slow gin. And I have never had any reason to doubt what was on his mind that night. And I finished that tumbler off, and I had a lot more. And what I'm here to tell you is that I began drinking that night at that party precisely the way I was going to stop drinking just 11 years later, but crawling then on my hands and knees. I drank that night. At some point that very first night, I blacked out, and late that night I passed out, and I'm sure the next morning when I came to, that I was filled with remorse, that I was humiliated, that I was ashamed of myself, and yet I was never going to drink any other way. All I know to tell you about me and what happened to me as I began to drink is to tell you what it says in the beginning of our book in the doctor's opinion, and it says there much better than I can. It says men and women drink, alcoholic men and women drink, essentially because we like the effect produced by alcohol. And that's why I kept drinking that first night, and that's why I picked up that last drink I ever took. It was for the effect produced by alcohol. I used to want to try and explain in detail what happened to me when I began to drink, and you know, I finally just gotten it real simple. I drank because it felt good. And that's why it's not any more complicated than that. See, it made it easy for me to do things that had always been impossible for me. I was shy. I was so shy it hurt inside and withdrawn. And when I drank, it made it easy for me to loosen up, to party, dance, be with people. I had never been able to do those things. And naturally for me, like it was for you, it was an answer right away. It was an answer that I never let go of from that point on. It talks in that very same part of our book about crossing an invisible line between something that's called normal social drinking and alcoholic drinking, and I cannot talk about it. I don't know what normal social drinking is. I had a lot of trouble with my drinking from the very beginning. And it says that we lose the ability at some point, if we are an alcoholic, to distinguish between the true and the false, and our drinking life begins to seem the only normal one. And that was my experience almost right away. I began carrying a pint around that college campus and mixing myself drinks all through the day because it made everything so easy for me, and it made me a part of a world I had never been a part of. And I began to start to get into trouble, and my attitudes began to change. And our stories can all sound real different on the outside. They're rarely very different on the inside. And whatever I have heard someone say from a podium, whether we're talking about our drinking or our recovery, I hear us talking about changes in our attitude. And my attitude began to change as I drank. The people I was attracted to, what I was comfortable with, began to shift. And this was the 60s. It was a time on colleges, campuses everywhere, where there was a lot of demonstrations, a lot of political activism, a lot of radicalism. And these were the people I was attracted to and I began to spend my time with. And it was at that point that I began to use a lot of drugs. That was going to be another problem for me, too. And a little time went by on this campus, and I was drinking and I was using, and other things that had once been very important to me weren't very important anymore. I was there to party now, and I was arrested in one of these demonstrations, and that was not a bad thing at the time. You know, actually, it was a real good thing, because this was the 60s, and it was real important to be arrested somewhere for something. You know, it was sort of a requisite of the time, so it was sort of like I had taken care of that, and this was a big deal in Long Beach. They put all of our names on the front page of the Press Telegram, and I always say that is because nothing ever happens in Long Beach. This was big news, and I was loaded anyhow. I didn't feel bad about it until late that night when I was bailed out by a group from the city jail, and then I thought about having to go home and having to face that hard Irish father and try and explain to him why I was in trouble yet again, because this hadn't been the first time there was trouble. And rather than do that, I waited to the next afternoon when I knew that man wouldn't be there, and I walked in the house with a couple cardboard boxes and emptied out a few drawers, and I left. And I was never going to live any other way until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I moved from Long Beach down to Huntington Beach. And I always talk like Lindy did about the place I moved into, because that never changed either. It was small, and it was cheap, and it was dirty, and there were a bunch of us living there. And I can remember laying on a mattress on the floor those first nights and looking around, and all I know to tell you is I had not been raised to be comfortable in a place like that. And yet I can tell you how I felt. I felt absolutely at home. I felt as if for the first time in my life, no one expected anything from me, and now I was free to do and to be whatever I wanted, and I was going to believe that for a long time. I lived in Huntington Beach most of that next year, and I don't know if you all know the distance between Long Beach and Huntington Beach, because this is the only geographic I ever took. It's about 10 miles away, and I've always envied speakers, you know, that came to in Dallas and Florida and London. You know, I went to Huntington Beach. I just always found it real hard to get up off the floor. I never went anywhere. And a year later, I moved back into Long Beach to run those streets, and I never left again. And I always talk about, and it's hard, you don't know Long Beach, but I moved in on the west side of town off a street called Anaheim Street. And it was a hard part of town. I was very comfortable there. I felt like everyone was doing the things I was doing, and I wasn't any different. And I just felt, I felt safe. I felt protected in an odd way. Because by this point in time, I was a chronic alcoholic. I had been drinking heavily on a daily basis from the very beginning. I was not yet 21 years old and legally able to buy a bottle for myself. And yet I'll tell you, I needed to be here. No one could have convinced me of that, but I needed to be here. Before I was 21 and able to buy that bottle, I was in a lot of trouble. I had been arrested several more times. By now, I had, of course, dropped out of school. I had been running the streets. I was an alcoholic. I was addicted to several different drugs. Before I was 21, I had come to in a locked ward out at Norwalk. That's a state mental hospital, as a suicide. And no one could have told me I was having a problem with my life. I had become literally unemployable by this early period in time. There were going to be times all through my sobriety that I would come up with little jobs, and I lost every one of them. I was fired because I would show up drunk or loaded, or I would just drift away. I never knew how to take care of myself, and I found a simple solution for the problems of living for me. And I began moving in with what became a long line of men. You know, I moved in with anyone who would just take me in. And then I stayed there until I was kicked back out, because that is how it always went for me. And I know, especially if you're new, it sounds as if I am only talking about the circumstances of my life. And that's not true. What I am really telling you is that I have always been someone, one way or another, who has said, I can't do it. You do it. See, you buy it, you fix it, you cover for me. You know, you make up the difference. You get it. You love me. I can't. and the doorway for freedom for me here in Alcoholics Anonymous was that when I came here, there were those who took the time to say it was up to me. They said it was my decisions and that they would help me, but I was the only one who could put those steps to work in my life. And I believe that has been what has given me the freedom I feel today that I feel right now. And I know that's where it came from. It's looking back, of course, that I see that. And so the years went by, and none of them were pretty years. I stayed there on the west side of Long Beach, and a little time went by. And I always talk about sitting on some stone steps on the west side of Long Beach early one afternoon and staring at the ground between my feet. I was 23, maybe 23 and a half years old. And I sat there by this point in time. Not only was I an alcoholic, I was a drunk. And I had been in a lot of trouble through those years for that reason, and now I was a heroin addict too. And all I have to say from these podiums about how I lived in those years, see, is just to tell you that I am someone who has learned everything, I hope, that I ever want to know about shame and degradation and humiliation and remorse, because that is a dirty way for a woman to live. And I lived that way freely for a long time after I came to you. I wanted to say that it was conditions and circumstances that made me into the things I became before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And some of you told me I was going to have to learn how to take responsibility for myself, and you were right. No one ever broke my arm. I lived the way I lived because it gave me what I wanted most, and what I wanted was to feel good. And that was my solution to the problems of living. I sat there on those steps, and I was 23, staring at the ground, and I felt old, and I felt all used up. And I was all burned out inside. 23 is young to feel that way. And I was still years away from getting to Alcoholics Anonymous. And all I know to say is if you're an alcoholic, that's your story too. It may just sound different. You know, sooner or later, it's going to take it all. And it may be fast. It was very fast for me. Or it may be slow. It may sound like another story altogether. But sooner or later, it's going to strip it all away. And there I sat, and there was nothing I could do to change what had happened to me in my life. It hadn't been that many years since I walked away from that girls' school with all those hopes and all those dreams. And there I was, absolutely helpless to change what had happened to me. And those years are a story of being in and out of the city jail, you know, and the drunk tank. I'm not talking exotic criminal behavior here, just, you know, the drunk tank. And and all the little bars up and down Anaheim Street and Coast Highway. It's about being in and out of all those motel rooms and hotel rooms up and down Anaheim. It's a story about being in and out of the free clinics and the county health facilities and the pawn shops. It's about panhandling on the streets of Long Beach and the blood banks and the pike, and that was how I lived. That was the best I could do with myself. And for a long time, it was hard for me to talk about those years. There was a lot of men, and there was a lot of agony, and there was a lot of ugliness. And I have had to learn that in God's hands, my past has become the greatest asset I have. And I can give it to you real freely because I don't have anything else to give you. It's all I have. All I can tell you is what happened to me. And then I can tell you what happened when I came to these rooms. And that is the only message I know to give. And so that is how I lived. And it went on and on like that for a long time. And I came to some time later. And there's no point in going on and on about it, you know. It was just the streets, and it was bad times. And it had started out to be fun and to be cool. And, you know, there were a lot of people living the way I was living at the time. I didn't think it was bad. Sometimes I sit in meetings, and people come up and say, oh, you poor thing. And I'll tell you honestly, I never thought it was bad. Everyone I knew was doing the same thing. And the time went by, and I ended up Some years later, I was in a room in downtown Long Beach laying on the floor in a hallway. I was black and blue, and I had apparently been laying there for days. And as I came to, someone was stepping over me. And I sat up and propped myself against the wall, and I looked around, and one more time, I had a solution for what had happened in my life. And I looked around, I thought the problem here is all these junkies I'm living with. It is no wonder I am always in trouble, because that's the way I like to look at life. It's always been you. It never was me. It was you, and it was circumstances, and it was conditions. It was people, places, and things. It was no money. And it was often the cops. And it was bad luck and bad timing and crummy karma. You know, it was... It was not me. And so this was my attitude that day, too. And I thought, what I have to do is get out of here, and surely things have got to improve for me a little. Because you can't live the way I was living and not know there's something wrong. I just never knew I was going to have to sit in these rooms to find out what was wrong. A condition of probation I had at several different times was that I get some psychiatric help. And I had done that to no avail whatsoever. And it's because everything I know about honesty I have learned sitting in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, listening to you be honest. I don't know how. I never did. And I could sit there and I would talk about using, you know, if you're an addict, you can use that for a lot of things, for a lot of sympathy, a little time, a little help, a little money. But I'll tell you what I never did. I never sat there and talked about how much I was drinking. I didn't say that I couldn't stop. I didn't know that. I never talked about how I was living. If you didn't already know, it is no wonder I never got any help. And so I had to wait to come here, because what I thought was that I was a depressive, that I was psychotic, that I was schizophrenic. I thought it might be a lot of things. It never occurred to me at that point that I was an alcoholic. Drinking was what I did, and I didn't spend any time thinking about it, and I didn't listen to anyone that wanted to talk to me about it. And so I looked around, and I ended up a few months later, and it was a little hard to do to get from that room down there. I ended up in North Long Beach, and it was hard to do, not because anyone wanted me to stay. You know, I want to make that perfectly clear. No one asked me to stick around just a little bit longer. And the easiest way to explain that is to tell you I once spent a month in Sybil Brand, the L.A. County Women's Jail. I was yellow, and I had a front tooth knocked out. It was another bad time in my life. And I sat there from the very first night waiting for one of my friends, because you know how tight you think they are out on those streets, waiting for someone to come and bail me out. And over a month later, I was still sitting there waiting. You know, no one wanted to come and claim me, and it had been like that for a long time. And so I cleaned up enough, and I got this little room in North Long Beach, and I went out, and I came up with a job. And I will never forget how hard it was to get that job. See, I was trying to make things right one more time, because I'm sure you've gathered by now I did not have a resume or a... or a list of references to hand out. See, it was hard to get this job, and I wanted to keep it. And they fired me less than 3 months later when I walked in there at 8 o'clock in the morning. And it had occurred to me not to do a lot of other things. It had never occurred to me not to drink. I drank because I needed a drink, and that was as far as I thought about it. And they fired me because it was obvious I had shown up drunk. What I drank the last 3 to 4 years I drank was Santa Fe White Port. And I drank Santa Fe because I liked it. I never knew. I know it's not a classy drink. I mean, I know that's true. I never knew I was going to tell large groups of people that I drank it either. I drank Santa Fe because it was very cheap. You can't get anything any cheaper. And it did what I wanted to do. And I'll tell you something about Santa Fe. If you don't drink, you never drank it, and you might not be aware of this. And if you're on your way back out, you ought to know it. You cannot buy a more honest drink. You know, it says everything you need to know about someone that's buying it. And And what you may not know is you can smell it coming a long ways away. And so, of course, they fired me. And I went back to this room I was living in. And I'm going to talk about that next period of time very briefly, only because I was coming to the very end. I would drink and pass out. I had this little money left that they'd given me from this job as when they let me go. And pass out and come to, and I'd reach for a bottle and drink again. And I would sit there and think, you know, because there was no one this time I could turn to. My family had shut the door on me years before. They were so ashamed of what I had become. There was no friends. There was no one. This time there was no man either. It was just me, and there was just a bottle, and there I sat. And I would think today is going to be just like yesterday, and yesterday was no good. And tomorrow is going to be just like today, and it won't be any good either. I was 27 years old, and I was waiting to die, and there was nothing I could do about how bad I needed another drink. And at some point in that period of time, I remember getting down those stairs and getting down to the corner. I needed to cross that street to get to a liquor store. And it is this moment that I use when I read the phrase in our book, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And we all have one of those moments. And for me, as I stood on that corner, I was dirty. I couldn't take care of myself at all. I had been in the same clothes for a long time. I was shaking, and I stood on that corner, and I wrapped my arms around myself, and I began to cry. It was morning, and I was scared to cross the street. I was absolutely terrified to cross the street, and it was a little street, and I couldn't do it. I was a grown woman, and I couldn't take care of myself anymore. And in the end, that was what it all came down to. I was pitiful. I did, in early years, look at the things that happened to me in sort of a romantic way because I'm such a fantasizer, and there wasn't anything romantic left about it. I remember myself on that corner, and I was not dramatic, and I was not tragic. I was pitiful. And I use that so I can stay humble inside. That was my condition. It wasn't any other way. And so this time in this little room went by, and I don't remember it. I have weeks and months in my life I still don't remember. And I don't know all that went on. I just know I was alone, and I was drinking, and I was getting a lot sicker. I shook all the time, and I couldn't walk right anymore. I would crawl to reach that bottle when I could no longer walk. I am someone who had to sit in meetings to understand that my jaws clenched up and I drooled as a result of alcoholic paralysis. I did not know how sick I was. I didn't know. I had to listen to you here and find out how bad and how sick I had gotten with that bottle. And a Sunday morning rolled around and I reached for a pint to bring it to my mouth to take another drink. And as I did, something happened to me. And it was a simple thing. It was just that as I sat there and I reached for that bottle, I saw myself for the very first time in my life precisely as I was. And I wasn't any of the ways I had ever told myself. I saw myself sitting there, and I was simply a hopeless, helpless, alcoholic woman. I was a drunk, period. And that was the beginning for me. I never know, even today, the difference between beginnings and endings. All I ever know or can focus on is the pain or the hurt, the anguish of the ending. I never stop to think that nothing ends and no door closes, but that another one doesn't begin. That's how life is. I didn't know that as I sat there. I believe it is a gift for me, and I believe it's a gift for you to sit one more time in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because of what I did next. I believe it's a gift. I found a dime, and I went to a pay phone in the building next door. I didn't have a phone, and I dialed information for the number of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still don't know today why I did that. Until I learn differently, I simply have to believe that at some time in one of those little hotel rooms or one of those bars, someone sat with me and talked to me about a place for people like me to go, and they called it Alcoholics Anonymous. All I know is that the name was there when I needed it, and it has been that way for me ever since. A woman came, and she picked me up, and she took me to a meeting. And I can't remember that first meeting because I was too drunk to sit up in that chair. She had to help hold me straight. And the only thing I remember is that after that meeting was over, people gathered around me and they gave me their phone numbers. And I want to thank you. I want to tell you I am here today because you acted like you wanted me back. I was filthy and I was drunk, and I cannot imagine it makes any difference what condition we get here in. She dropped me off, and when she did, she said, "You know, Johanna," she said, "you shouldn't be alone." She said, "I want to come back here tonight, and when I do, I want you to come with me. I'm going to make arrangements. I want to take you to a woman's recovery house." And I had never heard of such a thing. I didn't know what she was talking about. And she explained it to me. She said it was a place where a group of women lived together. And she said they didn't drink. And they tried to help each other. And I thought that sounded like a real bad idea. You know, if there was any place I did not want to be, it was with a lot of women that weren't drinking. You know, it just... It sounded bad, and I told her I'd gotten the idea of AA, and I was just fine. And and that woman came back that evening to pick me up. She was my first example of what we mean when we talk about service and Alcoholics Anonymous. She was a fine woman. And all I know is that when she took the time and came back to that door, because there was no way to call me, I got up and I went with her. And I don't know why I did that either. She took me to a place in Bellflower called Little House, and it really was. There were maybe 7 beds. There was a little tiny place. And the house mother met me at the door. Her name was Big Betty, and I always talk about her because Big Betty was the first example of what we mean when we talk about love here in Alcoholics Anonymous. She was the first that showed me. She met me at the door as this gal brought me in. And Betty was about 6'3", and she weighed maybe 300 pounds. And she was from the hills down there in Oklahoma or something. She was a lot older than I was. We couldn't have been more different. And she was intimidating. Of course she was intimidating if you're new and you're skinny and you're real sick, you know. And she walked over to me, and she put her arms around me, and she rocked me, and she held me, and she said, "Honey, it is going to be okay." And I have never forgotten how good she made me feel. I knew she was wrong, you know. I didn't even know what I was doing there, but she made me feel good, and those gals put me to bed. And I hallucinated, and I was very sick. And sometime in the next 48 hours, I left. And I left because I needed a drink a lot more than I needed you. And I hope I never forget how much I have needed one more drink. That was the only point for, excuse me, for my life. For a lot of years. I'm someone that has to say there is absolutely nothing I have not done at one time or another for just one more drink or to fix one more time. And it is a miracle what you have done with my life. I left, and the only thing I was to do right in that next year was to keep drifting back. And that woman kept coming after me. She did things for me we often say you shouldn't do for newcomers, but she did them. I don't know. I'm here. And at one point, she finally convinced me to try another time to stay there for 30 days. And I had gotten real sick out on those streets. And and I could no longer put my words together so they made any sense. I couldn't talk right anymore. You could never have told me I would one day stand at a podium. And they brought me into that house, and I couldn't sleep, and I couldn't talk, and my hands shook too bad to feed myself, and they just held me, and they hugged me, and they told me it was going to be okay. They had a Tuesday night book study meeting at that step house that all kinds of men and women would come to, and I didn't understand anything those people were saying. I would listen to you read the things we read today. I would listen to you talk this talk, and none of it made any sense to me. I didn't understand what any of this had to do with not drinking. I thought that was all you were talking about. Excuse me, I smoke too much, and this is how I pay the price. I showed up there on the Tuesday night, the way we had to, for a book study meeting. And they would read the book and talk about it. And it didn't make any sense this night either. But after that meeting, one of the men that had come in crossed the room to shake my hand. And all he did was take a couple of minutes for a newcomer. It's important when we do that. He shook my hand and he said the most important words I have ever heard. And they're the most important words in my life today. He said, "Johanna, I just want to make sure you know that you don't have to live that way anymore if you don't want to." He said, "You just don't have to do it that way no more." And I don't know what else to say. You know, I had heard you all talk about not drinking. And I didn't know if I could do that. I heard you talk about sobriety. Thank you. And I wasn't sure that I wanted it. But what he told me was that I didn't have to keep going back out on those streets and keep doing what I had been doing to get there in the first place. And I never forgot what he said. Those were the words I used when I finally surrendered to this program. Some months later, it was the feeling that he gave me. I come now to the only thing I believe it is absolutely required for me to talk about when I talk about Alcoholics Anonymous as a program of recovery, and that I'm sorry. I'm going to quit tomorrow. And that's the concept of God. I found that hard to do in the early years, and naturally sometimes we do. We're afraid we're going to scare someone new away from this program. I have felt that way myself with newcomers, and yet I don't know how we're going to scare someone away that's afraid they're going to die. What other choice is there? And it tells me at the very beginning of this book that the only reason it was written was to enable me to find a power greater than myself. This book tells me lack of power was my dilemma. And it said I have to find a power by which I could live, and it had to be a power greater than myself. I have had to find something, and that's what I want to tell you about. I sat there in that step house. I couldn't sleep the first 10 nights. Waiting for the other girls to get up in the morning. And this particular night, because I had heard you talk about God a lot, we do more than we realize. This night I was trying to think of an idea that I could use, that I could hold on to, because nothing was coming for me. It seemed that I could not use the idea of God that I had grown up with. And this is not, I want to be real clear, this is not because it was a bad idea. I don't mean that, and I don't believe that. I'm simply saying that at that time and in my condition, I needed something else that I could hold on to, something that came easy. And I got what I needed this particular night in this step house. Because, see, I thought I'm going to leave in the morning. I'm wasting my time here. There's nothing I can hold on to. It will not work for me. And I sat up all that night trying to come up with something because I wanted to stay. I didn't have anywhere else to go. And I got what I needed that night in just the condition I was in simply because I asked. I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is a simple program. It's not complicated. That book means just what it says, not some other thing, just what it says and no more than that. What I had done, you see, is I had given up. I had stopped fighting for that period of time, whatever I had been fighting all of my life. That book asks us to abandon ourselves to God as we understand God. And that involves a surrender, and I cannot help but notice that no one ever stays here without that surrender, and it just means to let go, absolutely. And you've already heard a lot about that this weekend, and this was what I did, not knowing that I had done it. I was sick, I was a drunken woman, and there was nothing left for me, and I gave up. And that, following that feeling, something came over me that changed me from that night forward. I was quiet for the rest of that night for the first time in many years, and I had a feeling of God. It has never left me. I have never lost it since then. It was simply a feeling of God as a path or as a force, and it was plain to me as I sat there, even sick, that there had to be a place for everything and everybody, even one like me, just because this was how it was. And it was this idea of God that I used when I went through the steps some months later, when I sat for what I hope is the last morning after the night before and gave up for the very last time. And I don't go through the steps, but I like to talk about my attitudes in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially for people who are new, because it sometimes sounds like people that were around, they just breezed through them, and that it was easy, you know, and it's easy to forget the pain and the agony of trying to figure out what this stuff means so we don't have to drink or we don't have to go back out there another time. And it was hard for me, too, the way it's hard for everyone. It was hard for me to understand what you were getting at. I had surrendered to this program, and I had no problems with the first three steps. But I want to talk about the fourth step, because the day never came for me when I got up and thought, my God, this is a day to do an inventory. I'm going to start right now. What I did was hold on to all of my old ideas, every one of them, to the bitter end. And one of my many old ideas was the idea of stealing. I saw no reason why sobriety should interfere with something I had such a talent for. So I had always been a thief. I just didn't talk about it. And I was out this afternoon doing a little light social shoplifting. And I was caught, and the circumstances could not have been more humiliating. And the only thing I did right that day other than not drink was call my sponsor and tell her what had happened, because I wanted to get loaded. I wanted to change how I felt. I felt ashamed of myself for the first time in many years. And I have to tell you, I was ashamed because I was caught. But this was the way it happened for me. And she said, you know, Johanna, you are going to have to sit down here right this night and write an inventory. She said, you are not to stop until you have finished. And that was the way I got sober, with a group of people who thought that way. They said, this is what we did. If you want it, you are going to have to do it too. They said, this is what you do, one after another. And I sat down there with the way I have done so many things, so many times in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew it would not work, but I thought, why not? What have I got to lose? And to this very day, so far, I have always able to answer nothing. I don't have anything to lose trying to do it your way just one more time. And so far it has worked. When I was done writing, and that's why we put it on paper, it's different on paper than it had ever been in my head. I looked at those pages and what I saw was the life of an animal. And I saw no way you could all make that right. And I went and sat down across from a table the next night with another person, and I read everything I had written down. I read some of it very fast, but I read it all. And when I was done and I walked away, I knew what it means later on in chapter 5 when it talks about the sunlight of the Spirit, because then it was mine. You see, I had done what you told me you did, and that meant I got to feel the way you said you felt. That's how it works. And that brings me, and I should have mentioned it a few minutes ago, to a section at the back of our book called The Spiritual Experience. And if you're new, I would urge you to take a few minutes to read it. It will make things easier for you. And what it says there, because I describe something that is in the nature of a profound spiritual experience that night in that step house, it's real important for me to remember to say it doesn't need to be that way. It tells me in our book that for most of us it's not. It says we simply have a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And it goes on to say that for many of us this personality change is also what we call a spiritual experience, and that it is educational in nature for many. That means it happens slowly over a period of time. It says we recognize that change in the newcomer long before he sees it in himself. It's what happened when we see that look change in someone's eyes. And I have seen that many times in the eyes of others, and someone once saw it happen to me. We simply have a profound alteration in our reaction to life. That's all. That's a simple thing. Anyone can use that idea. And we go on to finally to understand God does for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And I will be the very first to tell you, I can't do this. I don't know how. God does for me what I cannot do for myself. If I could do it, I wouldn't be here because I wouldn't need you. God has worked for me from the very beginning, sitting in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is where I come to find it. And then I can go on from there. And so it was with these steps. I worked my way through, and I worked my way through with pain, and it was hard for me to change many of my old ideas. A guy, one of the old-timers, walked up to me at my home group because I began to help with the coffee and clean up the ashtrays and set up the meetings. This is the way they did it, and it's what I did too. And one of these old-timers walked up to me one night before the meeting started and said, "You know, Johanna, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you have to learn how to stand up and be counted." He said, "In your particular case, I think you need to get a job." And I was appalled by this. You know, I thought I thought you were the nosiest people I had ever run into. You know, no one on the streets had ever been that nosy. And and I explained to him I couldn't get a job. This is because I didn't want one, is why. I didn't tell him that. Once you convinced me that this was a disease, was to apply for disability. Now, this was my view of the world. He told me, the way the old-timers always do, that I was too stupid to know what to do and that I should try his idea first. And that's why they get to be old-timers, see, they know this stuff. And he was right. You know, I went out, and someone did hire me. All I had to do was the footwork. And I mentioned that job only so I can tell you what it gave me. I kept it the next 3 years. It gave me the first I had ever known in my life of responsibility. And it is the keystone of my sobriety today. If I say I'll do it, I'm going to do it. And I just make it that simple. But I have never been that way. I got it here. And that job meant that I got a paycheck. I showed up, I did the best I could do, and they gave me a paycheck. And that meant I got to go out and rent an apartment, and I paid for it. I had never been able to do that. That was how I learned how. I sat and cried. I was able to open a checking account. I was 28 years old when I got sober, and I had never had one. And I cried the night I first wrote a check to pay one of my own utility bills. And I know to many that sounds like a very small thing. It was a big thing to me. I got here with nothing. It was a big thing to me. And yet the truth is that all the way through my sobriety, the important moments have been marked by small things. They sound small, but they've been the big turning points. And the truth is that it was the small things that brought me to my knees, not all the stories that can sound so bad. As much as anything else, what brought me here was walking into that liquor store early in the morning to buy that bottle of cheap wine, and seeing the look I always saw in the clerk's eyes and so many other places so many times, that look that's a mixture of pity and contempt and disgust. And all I know to tell you is that for 11 years, no one has looked at me that way. And I don't need more than that to have been overpaid in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would never have thought to ask for as much as I have received here. It has been more than I ever imagined. I never thought I would have the life I have today. And I learned it in the small ways, the way everyone who is new does, just one little piece at a time. And I looked around my home group. I came here single, and I expected to remain that way. And I thought I was just, I would always be single. I thought I was going to go to meetings and go to work and go on these panels and make coffee, and that was going to be my life. And to tell you the truth, it honestly was okay with me. My life had never been so good. I got a quality of contentment in my very first year of sobriety. It happened right there at the beginning. I had never had it so good. And most of the time when I sit alone in peace with myself, I've never really lost that feeling. It was, my life was better than it had ever been. And I thought, you know, this is okay if it's the way it's going to be. And I didn't think I would ever be married. You know, a man explained that to me one night. We all, a bunch of us, got in a car to go down and listen to him talk down at Newport Beach. And we stopped at a restaurant in Newport, and it was a lovely restaurant, but there was a bar inside. And I got to watch this couple that sat down across from us, and she had just picked up him, or vice versa, sitting in the bar, and they were drunk, but they weren't obnoxious yet. They were really cute. And I was sort of getting a kick out of watching them. And I turned to this guy and I said, you know, no one ever did that for me. No one ever brought me to a place like this and bought me dinner. And he looked at me and he started laughing. And he said, my God, Johanna, no one ever found it necessary. And that was cold. It's just that it was true. You know, what I thought, as much as I've learned to laugh about it today, and I want to talk for a moment to the woman who is new, is I didn't think anyone would ever have me. I felt dirty, and I felt bad, and I thought I was worthless. Self-respect and self-esteem have been two different things for me here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I earned back my own self-respect by trying to live these steps in my life, applying the discipline of the steps to my life a day at a time in every area of my life. That's what they told me to do, and that gave me some self-respect. Self-worth has been another thing, and it's been very slow for me. And naturally, that's so. You can't live the way I did and feel real good, real fast. It was slow, and so that's why I thought I would always be single. And there was a guy in my home group, and a gal named Dottie introduced me to him one night, and she said, you guys ought to go out. And I said, my God, Dottie, how can you suggest that? And she looked at me, she said, he's a real nice guy, he's fine. And I said, that's a newcomer. And I was 6 months sober myself, you know. We began dating, you know, the way you do these things, and then we broke up. There was all this emotional crisis. That's the way we do it here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then we got back together, and time went by, and that man asked me to marry him and to be his wife. And we were married some 6 months later. I was 15 months sober, and he was 9 months sober. And in May, we will be married 10 years. And I think that is, thank you. It's pretty good for two newcomers that got emotionally involved, you know. I talk about the day I was married just for a second because I'm a woman and it's important to me. And I walked down the aisle of a large church in San Clemente overlooking the ocean to be married by a priest from my home group. And that church was full of friends. It was full of members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you watched me come down the aisle and you cried to see me. And I had a long white dress on. That should never have happened for me. And I felt real good. I felt like you had made me into something that was beautiful for someone else. I felt like a lady that day, and all I mean by that is that I felt like I could look you in the eye, and I didn't have to hold my eyes down anymore. I walked down the aisle of that church on the arm of the man who had told me I didn't have to live that way anymore if I didn't want to. My father died as a result of alcoholism, and that man did that for me. And I meant the vows I took that day. My mother was there. I was a daughter again. My sisters were there. My brother sat in that church, and I tried for years here at Alcoholics Anonymous to carry this message to my brother. He has a hard story, and I had walked into county jails and honor camps and the city jails and the county, the penitentiaries and the nut houses, trying to tell him he didn't have to be there anymore, and he never wanted to hear that. I believed just a couple of years ago, as I sat at a table at my mother's looking at my brother, I was looking at a man that was going to die in the next few months. He was so sick. And one more time, I tried to talk to him, not as my brother, but as the way I would talk to anyone who needed to hear about Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I was done this time, he looked up at me because I said, I'll take you anytime you want to go. I'll take you to a meeting. And he said, I will go anytime. You'll just come get me. And I did, and this last December, I got to watch my brother take a cake for 2 years of sobriety. And now there's two of us here, and a lot of my family never made it. And I guess you can imagine how I feel about that. And I meant the vows I took the day I got married. I meant them as much as I have ever meant anything. I wanted to be a good wife. And yet I have to tell you, the hardest thing I have had to learn how to do in sobriety is learn how to live in peace with another human being. You know, I have never had any trouble living in a room by myself. Many, many times I have thought, you know, and I talk about the details of my life because it's not real fancy. I'm a married woman. I'm going to tell you about my life. This is my story. It's how I have to judge how sobriety is working, because I do well in a meeting. What I have to look at is my behavior when I'm home. That tells me if I've got a program that works. And many times I have called that sponsor of mine up. Her name is Sue, and she lives in Orange, and she's one of those crusty old-timers. And I love her. And it was a miracle the day for me that I realized how much that woman loved me. You know, she loves me. And she helps me. And I call her when things are hard, and I call her when things are good. And many times I've called her, and what I've thought that I really need is one of those AA lawyers. You know, I've had it. I think I have taken all I should have to take, and I just get indignant, and I feel real sorry for myself, and I call her up, and I want to tell you I love my husband. I love him. He is a good and a gentle man. There has never been anyone like him in my life. I want, God willing, that we should grow old together, but it doesn't mean I don't have hard times. And she says, what you need to do here today, Johanna, is sit down and write an inventory. And I say, Shirley, you're wrong. It's his problem. And and she says, no, I don't believe I'm wrong at all. You're to write, do some writing, take an inventory, look at your part and look at yourself. And so I do that just so I can tell her I did it and she's wrong. And that's why she's my sponsor. She's not. And when I'm done writing, I put the pages away for a little bit and then I get it out and look at it again. And I'll tell you what. What I see on those pages always gives me the answer. I see that much less the rest of the 12 steps, I fail in the very first. I have forgotten that I am powerless. I can't even not drink left to myself. And my life has become unmanageable. And what I have to look at is my desire to control, to dominate, to take charge. I am forced to look at my own emotional dishonesty and my greed. It is me. It never was you. It's never been him. It is me and my reaction to life. And that's what a spiritual experience is about. That's what it tells me in the book. I need an alteration in how I perceive the world. And it has given me a lot of freedom to finally understand that I'm going to feel as good as I decide to feel. And the results of that are up to me. It took me over eight years to learn that. It's a hard lesson to learn, but it's worth it because it gave me so much freedom. And my husband went back out a couple years ago, and I don't tell you this so I can tell you his story. It's his to tell, but I want to tell you about me during that period of time because I came apart. You know, I'd like to tell you I handled it real well. I didn't. And I would just rather tell you how I am rather than tell you how I would like to be. And I fell apart. I was hysterical a lot of times. He was using, and I did not believe he was going to find it possible to get back here. It didn't look like it. I watched him lay in our bedroom on that bed trying to kick, and there was nothing I knew to do for him, and he was so sick. And I thought, you know, he may die. And I thought, this is the way my life has always been. Because I grew up in alcoholism, I have never known anyone in my life that was not an alcoholic or an addict. And that's all I know too. And I thought, this is what it always comes down to. It's always going to hurt. And I learned a lot of things from that period of time. I learned that I'm lost without you. I was willing to get help where I needed to go. It was at that point of time. I just want to tell you, because I think I should be grateful for where I found my help. I went to Al-Anon, and they fed me what I needed to hear. And the women in Alcoholics Anonymous, and not all of them, but many of them, held my hand and walked me through a hard time. Everything I know today about being a woman, about being a wife, has been given to me by the women in this program. I didn't know any of it. You gave it to me. And I love the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. You fill up my soul. You teach me how to be one of you. And so I learned, because I've always assumed, and it's a dangerous assumption, that because I like Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's my life, I will always be here. And I learned from my husband, because he felt that way too, that I don't get to know that. All I get is today. I have today, and it has to be sufficient to itself. I don't get to know if I'm going to be here tomorrow. I had to get real simple about sobriety one more time. I had to approach it like I was a newcomer, and that's a good thing to do. I learned also during that period of time, because my husband is sober again. He's sober because there were people that never gave up. They kept their hand out, and they pulled him back. I learned that that if we don't have each other, we don't have anything. We have each other or nothing at all, and I need to believe that if it was me, there are some of you, and I know it wouldn't be all of you, but there would be some of you that would keep your hand out to help me back. I learned many things from that period of time, and he's going to be sober 2 years again very shortly. Our life is, thank you. I have become the only thing I never wanted to be. I am a suburban housewife, and I feel good. I like it that way. I have the privilege of staying at home. When I was very new, someone took me to the roundup, and I heard a man talk at the closing meeting there. He was a very powerful speaker. He was the one that changed me. It's the most powerful talk I will ever hear. He's just the one that did it for me. And he said many, many things that morning. And one thing in particular he said that I never forgot, although I did not understand it at the time, I was too new. He said that being spiritual is being wanted, needed, and loved. And I did not know what he meant. And it was almost precisely 8 years ago that I learned. I was in a hospital bed down there in Orange County where I live, and I remembered that man and the way he had said that, and I understood for myself, because when I was 19 years old, I had walked away from a county building down in San Diego, and I had left behind a six-week-old daughter and that I could not and I would not take care of. And what I believe through those first years of my sobriety is that I would never have a family or children of my own. Unknown to myself, I had held on to the idea of a punishing God. I knew I wasn't good enough to have it. And I was there in that hospital, of course, because I had just given birth to our oldest son. It was a little boy, and I don't know how to tell you how much I wanted that baby. And I was so excited that night after he was born, I sat up awake all night long, thinking about what had happened to my life since I first sat in these rooms and came to you. And I thought about my sobriety and all those friends, and I'm someone who was always alone. I thought about the meetings I was a part of. I thought about my husband and my marriage and our home. And now there was a little boy. And I was, I thought all night about all of you. I thought about all the people that sat with me and put their arms around me, held my hand, that opened up their hearts and spilled out their secrets, just in the hope that I would find something here that I could use so I could be sober too. I understood that night that it is because of you that I am wanted, needed, and loved. I understood I have a place in this world at last, and I think that is all I ever wanted, was just that feeling, and it came from you. You gave it to me because I sit here and I listen to you. It came right here from meetings just like this. I took that baby home, and you see, the lesson I have learned is that God draws straight with crooked lines. I can't, and he can. There's a line in a book I use for my morning meditation that I love. It says, God has no reproach for anything he has healed. And I believe I have been healed in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have recovered from a fatal disease. And
And I have tried to learn how to work this program in my home with those children, and I'm almost done here. I don't have time, but I want to tell you, it has often been hard to be a mother. I assumed it was going to be easy. I thought you just bake cookies and you read, and that's the way it looked to me, and that's not true. I have another son at home. The oldest one just turned 8 last week. My home was full of first graders. And I have a 5.5-year-old. And oh, I love these little boys. They are my world. And it was hard for me to believe for a long time that I was a good mother because I am not a patient woman. All I have ever had inside of me in many ways, it's this desire to be better than I am. It has been so hard for me to understand that I am loved just the way I am right here, this moment, that I don't have to be some other way, that I have value as I am. And I have had to learn that I am a good mother. I am involved in their lives very intensely. That means I'm home, so I'm able to participate in their school activities. I've watched those boys play baseball for the first time and taught them how to swim. I've been there to walk them into the first day of schools and to work in their classrooms. I'm there for all of it. And look where I came from. You took a tramp like me off the streets of Long Beach, and you have stood me up straight, and you teach me how to live, and I owe it all to you. I am a woman with a family today, and I thank you for all of that. I was reading a book to my little boy the other night, and I started crying while I read it. There are some things when I read them that strike a truth so close to home that I can't help but cry. And he asked me why, and I said, it's a beautiful thing, and it touches my heart, and it's just hard not to cry. And I want to paraphrase what I read. It was a little book about death because a member of our family died, and I was reading to him about it. There was a paragraph in there with a question. Here's what it's all been about, and I want to tell you what the last 11 years have all been about. Because when people ask me how I'm doing, I always say I'm doing good enough. And it means a lot to me. I'm not trying to be funny, because I always wanted all or nothing. That was all I understood. And my attitude has changed completely. It's been enough to sit in meetings and sponsor a gal and watch her take a cake. And it has been enough to sit with you and spill out my secrets. It's been enough to listen to another woman give me her inventory and sit there and fall in love with her. It has been enough to watch you have your babies and make your lives, and to walk with you and you walk through me as we go through problems together. You know, it's been enough to show up at a convention or to show up at a party. It's been enough to learn how to be a woman, how to be a wife, how to be a mother. That's what it's all about. It has been enough, and I am a big believer in just enough. You have been enough for me from the very beginning, and more than this, I don't need. You've given it all to me. I was told when I was very, very new to become involved in service in some way, and I do hospital and institutional work. It is what I do best. And I have had a panel for over the last 9 years at a county hospital doing a bedside visitation. And I'm going to tell you about a woman I saw maybe 8 years ago, and then I'm done. What I tell you about her, there is nothing left for me to say. She was yellow. The whites of her eyes had turned orange. She was so sick. Her liver was protruding. And she was full of wine sores and cigarette burns. She was full of tubes. She had wrists that were like straws. I have never seen wrists that were so thin. And I'm sure that woman was younger than she looked. And another gal and I walked over to the side of that bed and say the things you say to someone who was new about Alcoholics Anonymous and not needing to live that way anymore. And this woman had blue eyes, and she looked up at me, and she changed something inside of me. She reminded me so strongly of myself. I once came to in a county hospital not knowing how I had gotten there. She looked at me and she said, "You don't understand." She said, "Drinking is not my problem." And you know how we are. You can't stop us when we're on a roll. And we talked to her for a long time, and she didn't want us there. She wanted us out of the room. And we finally just gave up. We left her literature and held her hand, and we told her someone would check back on her the next week. And we did that. And what I want to tell you is that she was right. That woman was right. Drinking was not her problem, and she did not need Alcoholics Anonymous because she was dead. She never got here. That woman never took a chip. She never celebrated a birthday. She never got a job or made a friend. She never had a cup of coffee with one of us. No one in her family ever looked at her with any respect. That was the end. I learned from her that I either have what we have in these rooms, or I'm going to have to walk back out there today to precisely what I left behind 11 years ago, and I see no reason to believe it would ever be any different for me. There is a line repeated 4 or 5 times through our big book, and hardly a word of it has changed each time. It says very simply that the great miracle for us is that we have discovered a common solution. And some part of me has known from the very beginning, just the way I was, but that's another way of saying that together, because we need each other so much. I need you. I need you a lot. Together, we don't have to live that way anymore if we don't want to. I thank God every day, and I make it real simple. All I have to do, and I mean this with all of my heart, is to thank God for each and every one of you. Thank you for having me.